It's the Press Play on Tape podcast, episode 11. I'm one of your hosts. What was that?
Oh, I was doing a crowd noise, man.
Give it to me. That's better. That's better. And over that noise is my co-host, Mr. Alex Boz, Oz Retro Gamer.
Hey, Daz. How's it going?
Fan-bloody-tastic.
That's bloody awesome, man.
Bloody.
Yeah, let's. Yeah, I thought you were going to follow that up with something else.
No.
Hashtag beep.
Gate. What are you on about, man? What are you on about?
I know, that's, yeah. All right. Yeah. I've started something that I can't stop, but that's right. And I've still got the squeaking chair. I'm really, really sorry. Daz, actually, before we get going, man, I absolutely stuffed up in the last episode. I was talking about the Commodore 64. The project name was VIC-40, and I mistakenly said it was due to 40 kilobytes. It was actually 40 characters, right? So going from the VIC-20, 20 characters, going 40 characters. That's why they call it the VIC-40.
Okay, so, fair enough.
That's all right. But no one actually pulled me up on it, but I know our special guest that we've got on today probably would have pulled me up on it, so that's why I thought I'd better clear it now.
I think he's actually grabbing you by his teeth and just shaking you around.
Well, so he should.
Yeah. Our guest, but please just let go of Alex at the moment. We have Rob Caporetto on. How you going, mate?
Yeah, good. Evening. No, shouldn't have said
evening. It is evening.
Yeah, good. Hope you're both doing well, doing great as well.
Yeah, we sure are, man. Yeah.
I'm sitting down enjoying a cup of coffee.
Yeah, we can hear you sleeping, man. Just stop that stuff. Go on mute for
FNC. See, Rob, this is what I have to work with, mate.
Yeah, but at least I'm up front.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't want to hear what I say when I go on mute.
Oh, no.
Oh, dear God.
Oh, man. So, Rob. What brings you here?
So I'm pretty much so by day I do various freelance development works. I'm currently doing some game stuff on the side. I'm working on a little arcade shooter called Backfire, which is probably a few months away. I'm also a fairly heavy retro YouTuber. I focus mostly on micros. Pretty much last month's favorite machine, of course, the C64, but I also do some Plus 4, Atari, Amiga, and hopefully some other machines like the ones we're going to cover tonight.
Nice.
Yes. About that, then, yeah. I like the old 8-bit micros just because there's a sort of rawness to them that you don't get with, like, console gaming and even more recent gaming. You know, there's that indie stuff these days, which is great, but it's usually really polished. Mm-hmm. There's something about the 8-bit days where it was just so raw and, you know, to sound cliche, like punk rock about it.
Yeah, it's got a harshness.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that, you know, because I'm a programmer myself, I look at what programmers did back in those days, and it's just some utter magic of what they're able to do. You know, I think of games like some of the ones we're going to talk about this evening, and what they can do on that limited hardware, limited memory, is just blows the mind. Even now when I, even just sitting there playing some of these old games, it's like, wow, they could do this. And, you know, and then you see stuff that comes out on modern systems these days that, you know, people still do it as a hobby, and it's just so inspiring. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. No, I totally agree. And funny enough, this is the second time we've had a chat over the airwaves. So, you can get Rob on the RD podcast as well.
Which was the end of 2014.
Oh, shit, was that long ago already?
It was that long ago.
Yeah, and that was obviously about the Commodore 64, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a good episode. It was with Sam Dyer as well from the
Bitmap
Books.
That's
right. So it's like we were up early on Sunday morning with that one.
That's right.
It was a great episode. Was glad to be on board.
Yeah, because Alex was supposed to rock up to that one, but he didn't want to.
Yeah, dude, you got the best in the business replacing me, man. So I wouldn't be complaining. I probably did you a favour. Rob's a man. When it comes to the 8-bit, especially the 8-bit stuff back in the early 80s, knows his stuff very, very well. And we had the pleasure to actually interview him on Oz Retro Gamer. So, if you haven't read the interview, please go on there and have a read. But Rob, man, I know you do, you've developed games, you're still developing stuff. I was actually loving your backfire.
Thank you.
That was just brilliant. I know Daz is probably going backfire, huh? What?
I've spammed enough of it on Facebook. So.
There was an exclusive during an interview that Rob told me that backfire, which is his game, and and I thought let me have a crack at this, and I absolutely crap at it, but it's just one of those games that you just want to come back to, really simple but addictive. And that was just one of the things that I learned something new from Rob, and I've known Rob now for a few years, and each time I speak to him, there's always something new and something awesome that he tells me about, and I'll just, wide-eyed and go, wow. So, and I know we also ride on Reset, and issue 8 came out, and you actually had a few articles in there, didn't you, Rob?
Yeah, I did a couple of reviews, Nightingale Ultimate Edition, I wrote the bulk of that and some opinions. There was a review of the Red Runner and Green Runner 2-pack, which is some great mid-terrest blasters. And I have my Reset Rewind column, which is where we look at a game that might tie in with the issue that's not talked about heavily, and just get all the writers to play it and write their thoughts on it and what they think of it after all this time. So like an evolution of the Zap Back.
Fantastic.
So for this issue 8, because it was all adventure themed, I looked at Bugsy, which is a text adventure by St. Bride's School, which is this... which is basically a bunch of Wimblers, like this school where they sort of pretend to live in like the 1920s, I think. And they, one of them was writing adventure games on the side and was getting them published. So I did a few. That Bugsy was probably one of the more known ones. They did, in Reset, the article has a link to a really good story about them. It was actually what got me interested in them in the first place and why I think I nominated it for the column.
Fantastic. And for those that don't know, reset.cbm8bit.com, go and grab issue 8, which was released over the weekend. Yeah, man, it is adventure themed, so grab it. It's awesome. And if you haven't read any of the back issues, grab those as well. It's free. Kevin does a great job and everyone else that writes and contributes. So, thank you very much. And Rob, I don't know where you find time, dude, between that, your work, your Half Hour 64 YouTube channel. I scratch my head because I try and do a few things and I lose my mind, but you seem to just keep on going.
I tend to probably push myself way too hard, but also backlog. I've been working on next week's review for the channel, which... I'll drop an exclusive. It's a look at Houston's Fourth Dimension compilation. Actually been working on that because I managed to acquire a complete disc copy of it before Christmas. I've got the review of that. I'm just putting the finishing touches on it now, and that'll go up next week, Friday evening Australian time.
Oh, wow. Oh, that wow. is an exclusive. See, Daz, we get exclusives, man.
I love you guys. I'm happy to drop an exclusive out.
That's pretty cool.
You're a legend, man.
I've got some good ones in future that I'm sort of planning. Sometimes I just go through my collection list and go, that would be interesting. And then curse myself for some of the bigger games that I'd love to cover but haven't had the time to really plan a review for.
That's always the case. Now, before we get into the main topic, man, I just want to know how you actually got into gaming and computers, especially, the old micros.
In terms of gaming, so I'm in my mid-30s, and that's sort of the age where gaming really came together. By the time I was like 6 or 7, I played the Atari 2600 at my cousin's place. They had, nice good old Woody 4 Switch, and I remember just playing a bunch of games when we'd go visit them. That was sort of the part of the family we'd go visit the most. And then Christmas, my gut feeling says 1987, we were at my grandparents' place, and my uncle gave to us, which is basically me and my brother, his 2600 Junior with 6 games. So it was like Yars Revenge, Boxing, Moon Patrol, Smurf.
Space Raid. Space
Raid, which was a bootleg of Mega Mania, funnily enough.
Oh, wow.
We were talking about that before the show, actually.
Oh, okay.
And the the last one I think was Strawberry Shortcake.
Oh,
I was going to say, let's see if you get 6 out of 6 like quality titles, but damn it.
Dude, Strawberry, yeah. Strawberry Shortcake is actually a rarity, mate. You can probably sell it and buy yourself a Commodore 128.
Oh, it's like that, is it?
It's only a loose copy, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, so we played that. Yeah, that was that era where you could still get Atari games cheap. It was so cool, you know, through HES. That was sort of where I started playing stuff, you know, borrowing games off my cousin. They eventually ditched theirs to get a C64, and we sort of followed suit a few years later. And that's where I think the magic hit, because just the sort of jump in games quality at that stage, you know, 1989 we're talking, the jump in quality to those games, just it's just one of those things that I think I fell in love with. And coding, I blame Commando for this. The C64 conversion of Commando was rushed to get it out the door, because that's always how it was with licensed games back then, to make Christmas. And so it's very, but you know, when you're playing it, you see those the sort of screen flicker when there's too many sprites on the screen. Mm-hmm. So I'm 8 years old at this point, and I've the egotistical thing of I can do better. I had no idea how to program a computer, you know. I read the C64's user's guide, and so I started trying to write it. Try to write my clone in BASIC, you know, not knowing about assembler or any of the real stuff you need to do to make a game. But that sort of got the programming bug, and yeah, I sort of developed that for a bit on the 64, eventually moved to sort of modern systems when I hit uni. And I sort of followed that, you know, doing web and mobile projects and game stuff on the side. And that's led to a couple of prior games, a little Asteroids clone called Meteor Swarm, World War II aerial shooter called Pocket Dogfights, which is on iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Linux. And finally, Backfire, which is I'm working on right now. And of course, I've done some stuff for other people. The biggest of those is a digital board game called Armello, which is I did UI programming on. And that's a title on PC, Mac, Linux, on Steam, and GOG, and Humble, and also on the PlayStation 4.
So, Daz, make sure you grab it.
I've seen it. It was actually on special. I should have grabbed it when I saw it, actually.
Yeah, it's worth it. I mean, I'm biased because I worked on the darn thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a good slow paced game. Yeah, I think if you're willing to put the time into it, it's a great experience. Especially if you get some friends and play multiplayer.
I guess the thing is with me, kids, the time is what I don't have, and
yeah.
it did look like a slow paced game, so it was like. What do I do? Because I knew it was you worked on it, and it was pretty much an Aussie game, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. So I was like, I'd love to support it, but I'll be just buying it for the sake of buying it. But
in look, single player at least, an average game is about half an hour.
Okay.
So, in multiplayer, it can drag out a lot because you know people will strategize and take their turn. But in single player, you could usually get through in about 30 to 40 minutes.
Okay.
I might
have to wait a little bit because Street Fighter 5 comes out next Tuesday. So, yeah,
put on your wish lists and grab it when you get a chance.
Yeah. So, but it does sound great though. I will give it a shot.
Wow, I can't believe that Rob was 7 or 8 years old thinking that he can code Commander. That is just some marvelous foresight, my friend. I can't. I played Commander and I thought it was great, but you're right. Looking back on it now, with older eyes, it's like, oh dear God. But back then, I thought it was great.
Absolutely.
But the fact that you picked up on that at that age, that is a special, special thing, man. There's no way I would have picked it at that age. No chance.
I just like noticed that it was wrong. I didn't understand why, you know, now it's like, okay, this is because the sprite engine is putting more than 8 sprites on a line because it wasn't sorting them properly. And truth be told, when Commando Arcade dropped, you know, that was nearly 2 years ago, my jaw just dropped completely because you both, I love it. I still think Commando on C64 is a great game despite the limitations.
I personally think it's the best home port. Personally.
Yeah, it's an utterly amazing. It's tight, it plays well, it looks good for the time.
And it sounds
the
amazing.
Soundtrack.
Yeah, I love the soundtrack, man. Rob Hubbard.
Yeah, it's one of his best songs. And I love the story with it where, you know, he basically worked overnight to finish it. Mm-hmm. Then woke up the next morning, copied it to every Commodore in the office. And as everyone walked in to start the workday, it's just that Commando music blaring.
That's great. No, I didn't know that. That's a great one.
I love that story so much. It's just the it's that part of that vibe of the 80s that I love so much. Yeah. And it's sort of why I do the channel, is I like talking about that era. You know, a lot of retro gaming content online, there's a lot of people who are focused, you know, very American-centric, and that usually means, like, the NES. And the NES is a good machine. It's got good games, don't get me wrong. But I think it's talked about disproportionately.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I kind of want to try and help stem the balance a bit. You know, you guys with Press Play on Tape are helping to do that as well. And I think every one of us that talks about, like, computer gaming will help redress that balance bit at a time.
Yeah, I recently just found a YouTuber named the 8-Bit Guy. Like, I think he's been around for a while. Have you heard of him?
Yeah. Series on how computer graphics worked.
He's amazing.
That's
great. Oh, that guy. Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
I actually posted one of his videos on the page, and he was comparing the C64 graphics and NES and how they both created graphics or something like that. I don't know. It was like, this is awesome.
It's a great series. He did a really good job with it.
Yeah, it was just a nice change from the typical NES pickup video. You know what I mean? That everyone else does. So
yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite channels for this kind of stuff as well is Chinny Vision. Who's a chap in the UK? He's a CPC fan.
Mm-hmm.
but he goes into massive detail. You know, the extent he does into like getting hardware quality captures from everything, and he's done hardware reviews looking at things like an Amstrad PC portable with like this weird fold up screen from the late 80s. It's he goes into a lot of detail. I mean, I disagree with him on points, but not in a way. But it's like that's just some detail. It's some obscure stuff that he covers really well.
Wow.
Are you gonna start your YouTube channel, Alex?
Me? Oh, I've been talking about it for the last 3 years now, man. At some point, I hope I will. I said 2016 will be the year, but, I said the same thing last year, so.
I hope our chat didn't scare you and I gave brain dump of hardware.
Mate, I'll come to your house and I will direct it for you, mate.
Dude, Rob actually gave me a ton of tips, and which was very, very helpful. It wasn't scary or daunting. It's just, time is one thing, and B, you just like Rob said, you want to do something slightly different. You don't want to do the same thing over and over again. So yeah, you've got to be very, very careful in what, this is my opinion only. So I want to do something that's going to be different, fun, informative. And if I can achieve that, great. But yeah, I'm not going to put a camera in front of my face until I'm actually comfortable that, I'm happy with what I'm actually going to come up with.
No, you're right. Because, like, I started my own channel at one stage. I probably only got about 5 videos on there. But,
I didn't know this.
I didn't know that. Yeah, it's still there. They're all there. And I did like, for example, the top 10 best fighting games that are not Street Fighter, or my top 5 favourite C64 games, etc. And they got the average views, maybe 500 views. No big deal. I didn't care. I only did it because I wanted to do it. Then I did a unboxing for my SD reader for my C64. What's it? SDIE, whatever it's freaking called.
Please don't tell me you got a ton of views on that.
I got like 10,000 views on that.
Oh,
thing.
My God. Okay. And all right. I'm sorry for anyone that actually likes unboxing videos, but... Okay.
Oh, but I did connect it and I did show how it worked, so...
Oh, well, okay, well that's all right.
But it's dark, it looks like shit, it's a horrible video, and I also did a video on how to load games up on Vice and how to set up Vice on your computer if you want to play 64 games, and that went stupid as well.
Wow.
But then, that was probably the last one I did, and I was like, and I had Tim and the guys telling me, Tim especially, because you should do more stuff like that. That's what people are, enjoying. I'm like, yeah, but then it's like, nah, I can't be arsed.
Well, I was going to say, you either do the stuff that's really popular, but you don't enjoy,
right?
Which there is no way your heart's in it, or you do the stuff that you really enjoy and your heart's really in it. And, and if you get 1 view, 2 views, 5 views, I really don't care. I mean, that's the same, the stuff when I write my articles. It's amazing. As soon as the interviews do really, really well, anything Nintendo, definitely, and it's just amazing. Like, you can write drivel and people will actually swarm to it. But yeah, no, it's Yeah.
It's a shame sometimes, because if you put a lot of effort into something,
it is a shame.
People don't recognize it, or they don't give the time of day. And
but as I said, honestly, it doesn't actually bother me one bit. I just I have fun. I enjoy it. And if one person enjoys it, great. If two people, fantastic. If more, well, it's a bonus. So if I concentrate on that, I'll go nuts. But I really, really don't. I have fun with it. It's you know, it's my escapism. As I've said plenty of other times. And I really enjoy doing it. So
that's what matters.
But we're going off track.
Exactly. I was about to say.
We've got our special guest here, who's an absolute subject matter expert on 8-bit, and we're going to talk about some obscure stuff today, which is awesome. So hopefully you and I will learn more, Daz.
We shall. I'm sure we will.
So you can do the introduction, Rob, of the main discussion.
And it is?
The Acorn 8-bits, the BBC Micro, and its sibling, the Acorn Electron.
Ooh-hoo.
Now, to start off with, I'll talk just a bit about Acorn, the company, and just the systems. So Acorn were really big in Britain. They were founded in 1978 in Cambridge by Chris Curry and Herman Hauser. Chris Curry actually worked with Clive Sinclair for a while, actually for quite a while, and the division was ultimately basically on computers. Curry wanted to go with one approach, Sinclair wanted to do another, and ultimately Curry left and he'd met Herman through some other means and they started Acorn. As part of that, Acorn was sort of the controlling group, and there was a subgroup called CPU, sub-company, and that was doing consulting work. They actually started off doing work on slot machines, like building computerized systems like that. That's where they sort of started getting their money. Eventually, they did all right from that, and in 1979, they launched their first system, which was called the System 1. And that wasn't a consumer system. It was actually designed for, like, laboratories and engineering uses. And the big thing at the time was only, like, £80. And it wasn't like a computer like you'd expect, you know. I guess at the time, things like the Apple II or whatnot. It was, like, a CPU board, and it had, like, a little hex keypad. So it was sort of that model that, you know, might be, like, the Altair or something. That kind of thing. But they iterated on that a lot, many times, from 79 till 1983. The System 2 to System 5, and they added, like, disk drives and a keyboard case and a whole bunch of other features, and these machines had, like, rack mounts and things like that. But they were still this laboratory, hobbyist, engineering sort of mindset. They weren't really, you know, I guess the comparisons, like, the Apple II being the big one at that time, or the Commodore PET. But in 1980, in sort of response to things like the Sinclair ZX80, they launched a machine called the Atom. And the Atom was basically based on the System 3 board. It was sort of like they designed a keyboard case that could suit a keyboard for these systems, but also to put the Atom in. And so it was, you know, basically the board put in that case of a keyboard, and they launched it £120 for just the kit that you put together, or you could get it fully assembled for £170. But this was a proper keyboard case and a nice typewriter keyboard, unlike the Sinclair machines, which are, you know, that sort of touch-sensitive, horrible thing. And the basic setup was a 1 MHz 6502, 2K RAM, and an 8K ROM with BASIC, and an internal speaker that had, like, one-channel sound, so, like, your PC speaker. It had a graphics chip, the Motorola MC6847. That's a chip that's used on machines like some of the TRS-80 color computer stuff. So it's a simple chip, but it does the job. And for what the Atom was, it was actually a nice little launch machine. But Acorn's engineers weren't really happy with it. It was sort of a on-high directive to build that machine. So whilst they had sort of some internal thing of what should we build next, you know, Parvin wanted to build a 16-bit system. What they eventually decided to do was to build a successor, a machine that would do what the Atom did, but did it right. And they started off, and it was codenamed Proton. But what happened was, during development, the BBC came calling, because the BBC had seen a documentary called The Mighty Micro, and that basically predicted the computer revolution of the 1980s, you know, computers getting cheap enough for everyone to have one in their house, and the kinds of things you start doing on them. And they wanted to provide some TV programs to educate people on computers, you know, how to use them, what they can be used for, and things like that. But what they wanted to do as well was to actually provide their own machine to use in demonstrations that you could then buy in the shops. So they put a tender out and a whole bunch of things eventually happened. And, you know, all the major UK companies at the time got asked. So Acorn and Sinclair and Tangerine, who do the Auric, and a bunch of others that are even more obscure that I can't remember. And eventually what happened was Acorn had only really had the Proton on paper. And they found out and they had 1 week to put it together before the BBC were coming to visit and to see it. So they rushed it together in a week in like some mammoth overnight crunching. And they built it. They got it running. One small issue where they had the clock wire incorrectly connected. If you've seen Microman, Microman is mostly real, but it has its liberties for drama. But that actually did happen. But as it so happened, the BBC came in and they saw it and they were blown away. The Proton was the only machine that met what the BBC wanted in terms of being able to, you know, the machine's capabilities of what you could connect to it and what you could do with it. It met it and exceeded it. So they were pretty happy. So at that point, the Proton became the BBC Micro. The original machines proudly say BBC Microcomputer on it and launched at the end of 1981. Originally, there were two configurations. The first configuration was the Model A, which was £299 and had 16K RAM. The Model B was launched at the same time. For an extra £100, you got 32K RAM, which is the max that the machine could handle, and also a whole bunch of extra expansion ports. A lot of those we'll sort of talk about as we come on. The BBC, so it's, again, a 6502 CPU, but this time clocked at 2 megahertz. There's the 16 or 32K RAM. You've got the ROM, which has Acorn's machine operating system, which is really innovative compared to other micros at the time. But to explain why, I'd get really technical and you'd probably be bored. But it's really advanced. There's also BBC Basic. Unlike a lot of the other micro vendors, they chose to use their own custom implementation. It's actually really powerful. You can do things like, it has an inbuilt assembler. So when I was doing programming on the C64, I used to use an external assembler and assemble it and make a binary program. With this, you could actually type it into like a basic listing. And it meant that things were really powerful. So, yeah, you could iterate faster. You could have a program that was written in BASIC and slowly rewrite bits of it in assembler as necessary. The video was handled by two chips. The first was the Motorola MC6845, which is essentially what like CGA on the PC uses and also is on the Amstrad CPC. And I gave them a whole variety of video modes because the chip doesn't give you like distinct modes. It gives you a whole bunch of capabilities. You had modes ranging from 160 pixels by 256, and you could have that in 4 or 8 colors, and you go all the way up to 640 by 256 in 2 colors. Along with that, there was a chip for teletext. So the teletext service that, you know, was very, I don't remember how big it was in Oz, but it was pretty big in the UK, and you could sit there and actually display teletext pages on your BBC, and that was pretty cool. Yeah, in fact, BBC used to power those systems as well. Oh. So, and along with that, for sound, it had a Texas Instruments SN76489 chip. That's the sound chip that's in the PC Junior, the Sega Master System, so it's the base, PSG, and the ColecoVision.
Oh.
It gives you 3 square wave tone generators and a noise channel. So that was sort of the base configuration. The Model A can be upgraded to a Model B. You just, you know, buy the memory chips, you do a couple of changes. And if you want to add all the expansion ports, you'd have to solder those in. And those ports give you, so you've got video output with like RF, you've got composite, which is only monochrome. So for monochrome to a monitor, then you had an RGB output. They tended to, because the BBC was mainly used in schools, you had nice, expensive, flashy RGB monitors. But these days you could use that with a SCART cable. That's how I use mine at home. And it looks really awesome. And then you've got like a cassette interface built in, which is, like the C64, it's actually got the remote. So I should clarify. So, you know, C64 data set, you've got the custom connector, but it's got the ability to start and stop the motor.
That's right, yeah.
The BBC has that but it uses just the normal household cassette recorder. You've got your earphone piece, your microphone piece, and a remote piece. So you can actually do that same sort of thing where it starts and stops the tape when it's loading a program, which is really convenient. Although fiddly when you're using like MP3 files to load games. Along with that, but you pull it underneath and there's a whole bunch of expansions. You've got the most innovative, that's sort of the most unique to the BBC, is a thing called the Tube. And the idea of the Tube was that you could actually plug in a second CPU. It was like a little external module called a cheese wedge that would sit. It's sort of, you put it to the side, you'd run this ribbon cable in, and you could run, like, you could have a second processor. And, you know, you could sit there. One of the common uses was to run a second 6502, and that let you run some enhanced versions of some programs and actually let you run some CAD programs that needed that. But you could also do things like run Z80, so you could have a module for Z80, and you could run CPM. These modules also had their own RAM, so they could have, they would have, like, a 6502 with another 64K RAM, and it was just, the 64K was just for that processor, and the processor inside the Beeb would then just be running I.O. and handling, like, you know, managing I.O. and all the rest of it. But you also had a external port for plugging in disk drives and even hard drives with the right firmware, and it also had a lot of room for ROM expansion. You could have what they called sideways RAM, which is basically, you put, like, little RAM chips in certain areas, and you could have extra stuff there. You could even get programs on ROM. So you could get, like, a word processor called, like, Vue, and you could even get some other programs to do that. So it was really expandable. Not quite as elegant as, say, the Apple II, which had, you know, those slots like a PC, but the BBC is a little, it's still a big machine, but it's a little more compact than an Apple II. And they did okay. You know, they got government contracts, they were period schools, and Acorn were making quite a lot of money. But in the home market, they weren't really doing so well because of how expensive these machines were. And because of, like, the Spectrum had launched and the Spectrum was really popular, Acorn decided to make a response to this. And in 1983, they announced a machine, the Electron. And the idea of the Electron was they wanted to take the technology that's in the BBC Micro and make it cheaper to produce. So it's got similar specs, you know, a 6502 CPU at 2 megahertz, 32K RAM. Again, the same Acorn MLS and BBC Basic setup, but instead of, like, the Motorola chip, the Teletext chip, and the TI chip, those for video and sound, they have a custom uncommitted logic array, ULA. Yeah, it's a custom chip that does all those functions. Now, you still get all the same video modes except the Teletext mode. It doesn't implement Teletext functionality. So you've got those modes from 160 pixels wide to 640 pixels wide. But they're actually a lot slower to access. So even though the Electron is technically rated at 2 megahertz, depending on the video mode, it can slow down. And this sort of impacts things for games. And sound-wise, you lose out on the sound. You've only got one-channel sound again, but it's got noise emulation. But the advantage was the Electron launched at, like, £175. So less than half, you know, a bit over half the price of a BBC Micro.
Yeah.
And because of that, you know, it became one of the more popular machines for a while to get into people's homes, at least after its initial launch. During development, Acorn and their partner Ferranti, who did the ULA chip, actually ran into a lot of problems producing it. And what ended up happening was Acorn wanted to launch at the end of 1983. They didn't. And it's one of the things that sort of damaged Acorn a bit, because they had like a massive backlog of machines that they couldn't sell for a while. It led to a lot of problems. And eventually, the Electron got discontinued in 1985 when stuff happened. But it was still supported for quite a long time, surprisingly. The next step for the BBC Micro was the Plus series. The BBC B+ 64 and the B+ 128 in 1985. With the Electron, they actually discontinued the Model A because the low-end model was served by the Electron. And so you just had the B, which was now decommissioned for the B+. And all they really did was give you updated versions of the internal system software and extra RAM. Now, the downside is the way the RAM is handled. It's not like, say, with the Spectrum. You know, with the ZX Spectrum, when they went from the 48K to the 128K, you could actually use it efficiently in your games. I've heard it was a bit tricky to program, but you could use it efficiently and do a lot of useful stuff with it.
That's very true.
Chase HQ is what I always think of, yes. But a lot of games loaded everything in one block. Unfortunately for the BBC, it was still a bit tricky to use to swap around. So you had part of it what was called Shadow RAM, because of the way the BBC did video display, you could actually, in some of the, in like say one of the modes, like it could take 20k of RAM to display, which is quite a lot of memory on a 32k machine. And what that meant, for example, with the Model A, you couldn't actually use certain video modes as a result because they just took too much memory. But it also meant that a lot of BBC games, and we'll talk about this later, is just they were really crunched for space as a result. So the Plus series had more RAM, but they also had a new disk controller, and that caused a lot of problems. Like they had the firmware and the floppy disk controller built in, and that meant that some programs, particularly copy protection, would mess up and not quite work. But they eventually fixed that with some other stuff. The final evolution for the BBC Micro is the Master Series, which is actually what I've got, the Master 128. They upgraded the CPU to, like, it's sort of the next revision of the 6502, the 65C102, and that did introduce some incompatibilities. This time now it's got 128K RAM, like the B plus 128, which is still set up the same way. It's got, you know, the core workspace, shadow RAM for video, and also this sideways RAM, which is special utility RAM. Now it's got a whole bunch more stuff packed into ROM. So you've got View, which is like a word processor. You've got Edit, which is a text editor. You've got View Sheet, which is like a spreadsheet, and some other utilities all built in. As well as that, there were a whole bunch of variations of the Master. You've got, so the base Master 128, you got what they called the Master Turbo, and that took the Master 128 and fitted internally a faster second processor, 6502 second processor running at 4 megahertz. So the BBC is already pretty fast because it's clocked at 2. But this made it even faster. Then there's the Master 512. That gives you a coprocessor card with an 80186 processor. So you could run PC programs on it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of their way of letting you run DOS programs at that era. And then there was the Master Compact, where they sort of redesigned it to be a split system. So there was the keyboard, and it connected to this little base unit that had a 3.5-inch floppy drive, and you'd sit the monitor on. Problem is, like most 8-bits, the BBC was heavily on 5.25-inch floppies. So they had to start issuing programs on 3.5, and they weren't popular, so the 3.5-inch discs never took off for it. Yeah, same sort of thing with the C64 and the 1581 drive. So that's sort of how Acorn evolved, and the Master was actually in production until 1993, funnily enough.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, the schools, you know, basically British schools, and a few other places. But what happened along that time, Acorn tried to bust into the UK, the US market. They tried to get set up there, and that didn't work out. They actually lost a fair bit of money because part of it, from what I've read, is down to the FCC, just like having to do stuff to comply with the FCC, because they didn't have to do the computer. They had to do all the add-ons, like, and that cost them a whole bunch of money. And even by then, this is like 1983, 1984, Apple were pretty much entrenched there in the States. So you could sort of tell how that works. So they lost a whole bunch of money, and what they had to do was they sold out to Olivetti, of all people, companies.
Oh, wow.
1985. And one of the big things that when they were doing this, they had to be very careful because they're working on a very secret project that is probably their biggest legacy, and that's the ARM CPU. The ARM CPU is a reduced instruction set computing RISC processor. And the idea was they weren't happy when they wanted to build, you know, the next generation computer after the BBC Micro. And what they found was they studied all the processors on the market, you know, the 68000, the x86, and all these processors. And what they found was none of them really made the engineers happy. They weren't really happy with any of them. So they took a trip to the States. They looked at a bunch of papers, and they decided they wanted to design their own. And funnily enough, the ARM CPU, they actually wrote it in BBC Basic, the original implementation of it. And they have this on file in the ARM headquarters. So, like, they wrote a simulation on the BBC Micro of how the processor was going to work, because it's so simple.
Wow.
Which is actually really interesting. But then, so Olivetti bought them, they got a bunch of cash, and they matured the ARM processor. Initially, they released a development platform on one of those cheese wedge modules for a BBC Micro. It was like £4,000. and you plug it in and you could write for the ARM processor. And allegedly, I've never seen them online, but apparently they've developed a similar thing for a more modern ARM processor that you can plug into a BBC Micro today and you get an ARM chip and do all that stuff even now. So that's pretty amazing.
That is amazing. But
so they developed the ARM processor and they made the Acorn Archimedes, which was their 32-bit machine in 1987. And that went through a lot of revisions. I've only played a couple of games on them. I remember my primary school upgraded to them once, but that was after I'd left. So I've never used a real one. I've only used an emulated one. And that evolved to the RISC PC in the 90s, which surprisingly were being made up until Acorn stopped making computers, which was 1998. But with ARM, the big thing that's why ARM is still here today was Apple were developing the Newton in the early 90s. And they'd done some tests and they found that the ARM CPU was the best base to expand. Like the ARM missed a few things that they needed, but it was basically the best pick. So they started working with Acorn to expand ARM, put like memory controllers was the big thing because Acorn's memory controller was part of the Archimedes chipset. And eventually they actually spun out ARM from Acorn in 1990 and became ARM Limited. And instead of being the Acorn RISC machine, it became the Advanced RISC machine. So ARM got really popular because, there were things like the Newton. I believe the 3DO was ARM-based. And a lot of embedded systems, eventually, like, when you look at things today, our iPhones, Android devices are all ARM-based. Your PlayStation Vita is ARM-based. The DS, Game Boy Advance, and 3DS are all ARM-based. It's such a really popular CPU architecture. And being free of Acorn allowed them to grow and ultimately survive and outlive Acorn. Because what happened was Acorn started losing a whole bunch of money. And by 1998, they'd had a new CEO come on board who did a review. And they decided that it was best to sort of get out of that computer market. It was pretty much hedged up by PCs. Windows had had its meteoric rise and it was, we're in the era of Windows 98 by now. So they were going to pull out of that. So they sold them off. There's a few companies that were still doing it. And RISC OS development was still happening, Pardon me. Like with the Raspberry Pi, you can actually download RISC OS for it today and pretend you're running an Archimedes. It's one of the reasons I want to get one, just to play Arc Elite. That's about the only game I've played on it. But then they started doing work in set-top boxes. They're actually going to be the network computer stuff in the 90s, and that sort of fizzled out as well, but became the focus. So they were focusing on that. And as part of this sort of separation to distance themselves from the computing history, they ended up renaming themselves to Element 14. And then they actually started doing stuff with ADSL or DSL, and that got them acquired by Broadcom. So Acorn's like technology is like the ARM processor, but they're now part of Broadcom, massive, massive company, all of that. And yeah, it's sort of where their legacy really kind of oddly lives on in so many split little companies.
Wow. Rob, that was comprehensive, man. I reckon I probably knew 5 or 10% of that, and that's because I watched Micro Men. Right, but wow, again, mind blown, man. I've definitely learned a lot.
It's very, very thorough, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It's one of those things where you just sit back and you just listen and learn. And that's why I thought, well, I'm not going to interject anywhere because I just want to listen and learn. And that's what I love about all these old companies or older companies and the fact that their legacy still lives on. That's pretty cool. But with the BBC Micro, man, I remember our high school had it. In primary school, we had Apple IIes. We only had one. But the BBC Micro, the 32K, we had it. We had a computer lab and there was like 30 of them in there. And yeah, we just didn't know what the hell they were. We just thought, what the hell are these? Why haven't we got Commodore 64s or, whatever? That's amazing, man, and that's why the BBC Micro just stuck in my head. I never ever actually saw or played on the Acorn, so I can't make comment on that. But the BBC, I do have a soft spot for it.
I mean, the Elk is really just like a BBC Junior. It runs. It's pretty much The design is a lot more compact because they removed a lot of the expansion capabilities. There's just like a little expansion bus. But yeah, mostly the same features. Yeah, you power it up, it still says the same messages, it's got the same basic. A lot of the games ported over with minor changes. Some of the really advanced ones didn't make it, but a lot of the simpler ones did. And yeah, they're nice little machines. I mean, I got my Electron first. I found that about mid-2014. I just saw a listing on eBay, and it's like, I know I really want a BBC, but the Elk was cheap, so I grabbed it. Nice. So that's what I started with, and, you know, put games on. I've got a thing called a GoSDC that sits on the back, and unless you pop an SD card with disk images on it. It is fiddly to use, unfortunately, but I've got games I can play on it, and I've also got a tape cable. And then I saw the Master last year, and got that for a pretty good price. I was pretty happy. Nice. And the Master has a compact flash hard drive, so I just copy stuff to a disk image, and it's all there, so I don't have to deal with that, which is good, because that machine is gigantic. because one of the other things it has is ROM cartridge slots, which were actually introduced for the Electron. Because you could buy a thing for the Electron called the Plus One that plugged in the back, and it gave you some ROM slots. So the machine was like just starting to get a bit fatter, and then you could install the Plus 3, which made it even fatter, but let you plug in disk drives. And the Elk started with the 3.5-inch floppies, which is really weird. Like, they actually developed the ROM cartridges, the 3.5-inch disk support, and ADFS, which is like their DOS, the advanced disk filing system, for the Electron first, and then brought them over to the BBC, which is really weird.
Oh, was that them?
Yeah. Wow.
Because I remember, I actually thought it was DEC Unix that introduced ADVFS, but...
It's probably, I presume it's a different, just the same name, but two completely systems.
Yeah, I'm talking about journaling file systems, yeah. No, sorry.
Yeah, ADFS is not that powerful. It's still a fairly simple system by comparison, I would imagine. But yeah, so enough of the hardware. Let's talk games.
Yeah, go for it, Rob. Rattle off your top five, man.
This is the part I like.
Well, I've got a list that's a bit longer than five, but I'll talk my top five and a few picks.
Yeah, go for it.
So, okay. This is in no particular order. So, Elite, especially playing the Master version, Elite is just the game that defined the BBC. You know, like, the BBC is probably the fastest of the 8-bit computers. And when you play Elite, you could see why. It's clocked fast enough that you just watch the 3D graphics very smooth on screen. And especially on the Master, it's actually got an enhanced version that runs in color. So on the original BBC, it was sort of like black and white for the top half. And then you had color in the instrument panel. For the Master version, it's actually got a more colorful panel. And all the graphics are blue and black. So blue on black. So it looks a little prettier. So Elite is sort of one of those games that really push the hardware. Another one that does is Exile, the side-on space adventure, which was written by Jeremy Smith, who developed Thrust, and another chap, Peter Irwin, who wrote one of my other favorite games, Starship Command. They teamed up and created this awesome adventure, Exile. You're an astronaut who is sent on a mission to this planet to find out what happened to the crew. So you fly, you've got a jetpack, you fly around, you've got to solve puzzles, open doors. It's all physics. It's an amazingly complex game. And on the BBC, it pushes the machine so much that when you want to save progress, you don't just bring up a menu and save. You have to actually do this weird combination of actions to reset the computer, to load the boot program in, and that's how you say they used up that much memory. I mean, Exile, you've probably played it, if anything, on the C64 or the Amiga.
Yeah, I have.
But yeah, the BBC was the original version, and it's just so much more impressive because they even have speech on it, which the C64 version didn't have.
Ooh.
It's actually a really amazing game. Then, of course, there's Revs, Jeff Kramman's Formula 3 simulator. He originally wrote it there because Acorn sponsored a Formula 3 team in the 80s, so they had to do a game. And again, that's one that shows off the BBC's CPU power. Like, it's a great game on the C64, but the BBC version is just that bit faster. Starship Command, which I just sort of just mentioned in passing. It's an overhead sci-fi game. You're captain of a starship, and you have to fly around and basically attack enemies that are coming at you. It's sort of a bit similar. You've got this weird keyboard layout, but it's just really tense because you'll be firing and they're draining your shields, and you have to, you know, are you going to try and escape? Are you going to use your escape pods? Because if you use your escape pods, you will, you can start again with a new ship, but then you've got to try and get a better score and things like that. It's just very primitive looking, but it's amazing to play.
It actually looks a little bit like Star Control.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now, yeah.
And then the last one of my top five is a game called Fire Track, which is written by a guy called Orlando, Nick Pelling. And that's just, it's a clone of like Star Force. And that also was on the C64. He actually did the conversion. It's just like a really fast-paced shooter, really bit gaudy in the colors. Like
pink, purple.
Yeah, very purple. But it's really fun to play. It's really, really tough shooter, but it's done really well. Probably one of the one of my favorites, actually. And some other games that are of interest. Games like The Sentinel and Thrust were originally on the BBC and got converted everywhere. Funnily enough, in terms of games that got converted to the BBC, there's a publisher called Superior Software, who was sort of like the number two publisher and eventually the number one. And they actually got licenses to do games like Barbarian and Barbarian 2.
How do they turn out?
I've played a bit of the first one. It plays okay. It looks really gaudy in the colors because of only eight colors, but it's playable. And this is the big shock. They did Last Ninja 1 and 2.
Oh.
And even SimCity.
SimCity, wow.
Yeah. Again, and those even appeared on the Electron, surprisingly. But one of the big surprises for me was Eurydium. Houston got commissioned someone to do a port of that, and it's actually pretty good to play. It loses detail on the C64 version. A lot of the formation, the crazy formation patterns aren't there, but it plays well. It responds good. It's fast. Surprisingly good conversion. And then, of course, there's Death Star, which is started life as an arcade conversion of Sinistar. And what happened was Atari Soft pulled out of doing home conversions of games. And so the author filed the numbers off, put a new title screen on, and shipped it to another publisher. And it's like, it actually plays a lot nicer than Sinistar because you just have a turn left and turn right key. You don't have to, like, have a weird directional joystick like Sinistar had in the arcades. And the only other home version before the Williams pack was a in development one for the Atari machines. Those are probably some of the more interesting ones. Like Acorn did a whole bunch of by the numbers arcade conversions, Rocket Raid, Planetoid, are the big ones there. Snapper, which was Pac-Man and then looked like Pac-Man, and then they had to change all the sprites. Those are some of the other ones. Oh, one more. There's a shooter called Gulliforce. There are two of them, Gulliforce and Gulliforce 2, which are like your Galaxian, Galaga-style shooters. They're good fun, but interesting tidbit is the music. They have really good title themes, and they have really good title themes because the composer was Martin Galway.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
They're really good tunes, and they're fun little shooters. Like, they're sort of like bedroomy kind of games of what was really popular on the BBC. Like, US Gold ported Impossible Mission and Beachhead. Ocean did a bunch of games. But a lot of those bigger UK publishers never really did games on them just because I think it was just the market wasn't there compared to the Commodore, the Spectrum, or the Amstrad.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the good titles came out through Acorn's own publishing label, Acorn Soft. And they eventually sold that when Olivetti bought them. They sold all those titles to Superior, who re-released them. And that's really how a lot of the titles spread around. So that is, wow, that's a lot, I think.
they're great little machines.
Like, some games come on them really nice. When they're done well, there's some really fast games that use the hardware well. And I really think, like, there are so many titles, and I'm sure our audience will mention some that I've not even played. Like, they don't have a giant library, but there's a lot of good games on there. At least that's my experience. They're fun little machines. For me, it was really to play like Starship Command and Elite on real hardware more than anything. Was why I ended up getting them to check out.
Absolutely.
Daz, have you experienced either the Electron or BBC mode? Have you played any games on them?
Neither. But I'm looking at screenshots of the BBC Micro version of Last Ninja. And you know what? It doesn't look too bad.
Yeah.
It actually looks a lot better than the Spectrum and Amstrad version, that's for sure.
Oh, wow. Well, there we go. The only game I played, because we had them at school, was Rocket Raid, which is basically a scramble ripoff. Loved it. There was no joystick, so we just played with the keys. But and we had the green on black screens as well. So it was no colour, but every single computer science class that we had, first thing we'll do, we would always sit at the back of the class and just fire up Rocket Raid. apart from, I can't remember if there was Guardian, which is a Defender type game.
So, Defender was there, and Acorn had Planetoid, which was Defender. Might have been that. I don't know if Guardian itself got ported over.
Right, okay. Yeah, it was a Defender type, scrolling left, right, and picking up, people off the planet. But, that leads us to the publisher of choice. And again, our guest has a right of picking the publisher of choice for this month, for this episode. And Rob's gone for?
Synapse Software. I like this a lot of the earlier American and UK publishers. They don't get talked about as much, so that's why I picked Synapse. So they came out they launched in 1981 by Ihor Wolosenko, I hope I pronounced that right, and Ken Grant. They mainly focused on the Atari 8-bits at first. So they had their first game was Dodge Racer, and they also did some applications. They launched with File Manager. The big hits they launched after that were Protector, which I think was Defender-inspired, and some others. Eventually, they launched games like Blue Max, Ford Apocalypse, and but probably some of the bigger ones. US Gold actually published a bunch of their games in Europe, and ultimately they went down in 1984. A bunch of business deals went bad, and they just lost money and were acquired by Brodabund, who ultimately shut them down a year later. So I'll go through a couple of my favorites real quickly. The first is Ford Apocalypse. 2D shooter, you pilot a helicopter through a sort of a maze of caverns. You've got to rescue people. And the idea is, you know, it's a simple shooter. It's pretty early on, but it's really good fun. It's a tough game. And it's a good challenge. Then there's Survivor, which is kind of like Bosconian. You pilot a little starship, you've got to go around and blow up bigger starships, you do it by destroying the turrets. Again, that was Atari first and got a C64 port. And my third one is Blue Max. The classic World War I combat game, you're a little plane, by plane you're doing bombing runs and things like that. I just love that one because it's an early flight game, and I tend to have a thing for flight games. So those are probably my favourites, I hope. They're ones worth checking out, although Survivor tends to be pretty darn rare from experience.
Well, now you actually picked exactly the one. The one that stands out to me is Blue Max. I'm actually playing it on the Atari XCGS. But the isometric view just I love on Blue Max. So that's probably my favorite one from Synapse. Daz, did you have any?
Yeah, well, yeah, when I looked at the catalog, Blue Max was one of them. That was hard, but I played on the C64, enjoyed that. Alley Cat, funny enough, I love that.
Really?
I used to love Alley Cat, yeah.
Oh, there we go.
I really enjoyed that game. And what was the other one? Where is it? Ford Apocalypse. That's probably my favorite out of all of them that I remember playing.
Oh, there we go. Remember, I thought you said, I don't even know who these people are, but it's
but
amazing.
Then I looked, they did Zaxxon and Choplifter as well, says he.
Yeah, and this is why Rob's the man.
Yeah.
pulls that out of left field. Everyone knows Ocean and everyone knows, MicroProse and whoever else we've had. So, Synapse Software straight out of left field. And,
Have you played Ford Apocalypse?
Yeah.
That's a great game.
I love it. I really want to get my hands on a proper copy of it.
Yeah. Now, Daz, you asked on Facebook and I asked on Twitter about the audience's favorite Synapse games. Yeah. Did you?
There wasn't really much of a response. It was one.
Yeah.
And that was from, where is the post?
Oh, Daz.
It's Rajesh Sin, your good mate. And yeah, he mentioned Alley Cat.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much it, yeah.
That was it from Facebook. Boom.
Yes.
I asked on my personal, on my page.
Yes.
And one of my friends, Anthony, who's a chap, a good friend I went to uni with, he mentioned as well, he mentioned, let me dive in. This is what I get for not being. He mentioned Pharaoh's Curse as well as Alley Cat. I actually really haven't played Alley Cat, which is surprising.
Really?
Yeah, I really should hunt the Atari one down.
Oh wow!
Yeah, that's one of those ones I know of it. I've seen the screens, but yeah, I never actually played it. I'm gonna have to. People have actually beaten me. I have to go check it out sometime.
Definitely do so. On Twitter, we actually had a few. We had Freakin' Frankie. Hey, Frankie was in Oz recently. He's back in the land of the US.
He's got such a cute baby face, hasn't he?
He does. He does. Yeah. It looks exactly like the photo, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Seamus 1 and 2, Blue Max, Zaxxon, Necromancer. That's probably all I've played. He actually, when I put the question up, he was the first to say, who? Who's that? So, yeah, I love the fact that this was a challenging one for people, but yeah, people actually took out time to look it up and were probably blown away by some of the games that they actually did do. Aaron White, he's gone for the Pharaoh's Curse on the 64. He reckons the artwork was amazing. Legendary Whizball, who warned that we better read his tweet this time. that was my fault. I actually missed it the last episode. Seamus 2, and one of my top 10 C64 Drelbs. Oh, okay. Now, Drelbs, yeah, I haven't actually heard of it, but I don't know if Rob has or not. But
I've heard the name, but I've never actually played that one either. I mean, that's a surprising thing as well, as a lot of games of theirs that I haven't checked out.
Yeah, but apparently it's actually, if you look on boards, people actually rate it quite high, so that's probably one to check out. Anthony Stiller, Ant Stiller, he's gone for Encounter. I remember loading a copy from a friend's tape, and we said, wouldn't it be great if this was a 3D tank game? And there we go. And last but not least, Mark Bell. He said, I had to look them up. Can't say I fell for any of their games, sadly, but Sentinel was all right, though. Was that them, Sentinel?
So Sentinel's a sort of Star Raiders-style game that they published.
Right, okay.
Not to be confused with Jeff Crammond's The Sentinel.
Yes, that's what I was getting confused with. Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Thank you for the clarification.
I should actually cover that one soon, because that one doesn't get talked about massively either.
Definitely. And I did ask a bonus question, Daz. Sorry, man. I know we're going over time.
Don't be sorry.
Acorn BBC Micro Games. Favorite Acorn / BBC Micro Games, and we had a few responses. We had Aaron White. He said, only ever used those machines back in the 87-88 when at school for educational programs. Well, that's what we did it too, but we played Rocket Raid. Tone or C64 Tone says, only really played Elite and Chucky Egg. Others were all educational things. And Stiller, here we go. He's gone for, I've only ever played two BBC Micro games, and they are Elite and Exile, and I'm pretty sure they are the best two games anyway. And he's probably right. Rajesh Singh, Rocket Raid, Strike Force, Harrier, and Imogen. There we go. I only know the first one, actually, unfortunately. And Ross or Super Goat Taku, Dogfight by Opus, Monsters and Repton 2. Well, there we go. I can't say that I know any of those games.
Monsters is like Space Panic, if it's the one I'm thinking of.
Okay.
So, you know, you've got the little plunger, you've got to knock a hole in the ground and then the little creatures wander in, you've got to push them through. Repton is, they're the Balderdash style ones. I much prefer Balderdash personally, but it's the same sort of thing. You dig around and collect jewels. So a lot of BBC fans love, or Acorn and Acorn fans love the Repton games. I never got into them. Like I said, I much prefer Balderdash, but it's the same style of puzzly, rock avoiding, diamond collecting action.
Well, there we go. And just like that, Daz.
That's it.
Can you believe it?
Done for another month.
For another month. And I don't know what's going on, but I look at the time, it's like, what? What? Where did the time go? I could have heard, you know, probably another hour worth of Acorn and BBC micro stuff, but unfortunately, all good things must come to an end.
Exactly. It's time. Goodbye, my friend. It's time to go.
Oh, I think I'm going to bust out YTT. Young Talent Time. What did he used to sing at the end?
Oh, jeez. Oh, he got me thinking. I used to always change the channel on my sister.
and remember what show followed that? The Henderson Kids.
Oh, jeez. I never used to watch that either.
Young Talent Time, Henderson Kids, and then it was It's a Knockout.
Oh, remember that's Knockout? Hardcore, man. That's the good shit.
That was a good shit, man. Yeah. On that note, have we got any shout-outs, my friends?
You go first, Rob.
Okay. I really love to shout out for good old Ant, Ant Stiller, because he's responsible for some badass artwork for Backfire. And yeah, a lot of like him, Noble Kale from Quarries of Scred, probably some of my biggest supporters, and, you know, and all my fans for the channel, a lot of people there. Tony Cruz Electric Adventures as well. Probably some big people I know out there. Yeah, that's probably my list.
That's a pretty cool list, man. Daz?
I'll add Tony Cruz as well. I can't be more thankful to that guy. The guy's a gentleman, and whenever I need some help, he's always there, always. So now, thanks for setting up that power supply. Unfortunately, the unit didn't work. I mean, your power supply obviously worked, but not my actual computer. So I'm going to have to get that fixed. But yeah, thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate it. Shout out to the guys at RD and CD. Who else? Let me think. Mr. Paul Monahan. Shout out to him. He'll be joining us next episode, Alex.
Oh, yes. Is that the one that we have to get up early?
Yes, we have to get up early. So I'm going to call you an hour prior, Alex. Ooh. So you can just get up. You're not an early morning person, are you, Alex?
You know what? I used to be, man. But yeah. I get older and it gets really, really hard getting up. You know, the bones are getting heavier. I don't know what's going on, man.
Well, mate, I'm not an early person. I'm not an early morning person. But when it's something I want to do that's exciting, my body gets up.
It is. And you know what? I love hearing your voice, and it always perks me up. So I'm looking forward to it, man. So, shout outs to everyone, man. Everyone on Twitter, Facebook, you guys rock. Everyone that's hearing us talk right now, you guys rock too. Thank you very much for tuning in, listening. And, we hope that you've learned something, because I definitely learned something new. Actually, I learned a lot. So thanks again, Rob. Thanks again for joining us, man.
Thanks, Rob.
That's great. Thanks for inviting me on.
And I'm pretty sure we'll have you on a few times this year if you're free. So looking forward to speaking to you again.
We'll get our people in touch and set things up.
Daz,
yeah,
you're my people.
Oh, good. No, thanks again, everyone, for tuning in. Thanks again, Rob. Thanks again, Alex, because you're a good bloke.
Dad, so are you, mate.
Oh, thanks, buddy. I was going to go there, but I thought, no more sack jokes.
You had to put one in, didn't you?
No, but you know whose fault it is? It's freaking Frankie's fault. He started
Frankie, you're in trouble, my friend.
He is.
Yeah, he is.
I'm going to have to give that baby face a bit of a smack.
Yes.
Stop it. Don't touch.
Oh, no,
I didn't mean it that way. Okay, let's just finish this off right here. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And until next episode, see you guys.
Bye.
See ya.